from Wisconsin to Tennessee, North Carolina to Utah, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Heritage Foundation's National Coronavirus Recovery Commission has put together a comprehensive set of policy proposals for reopening the U.S. economy. Rob Bluey is here with details. The federal government needs to do more than throw money at the coronavirus crisis. It needs to cut regulations and red tape to get the economy moving again. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth is here with the real story. Will the next stimulus program move from the essential to the nice to have? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine takes a look at what might be included in Stimulus 4.0. And William Shakespeare wrote some of his most famous works during a pandemic. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary on what we can learn from the Bard's experience. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. With the coronavirus pandemic having crested, attention is now turned to how to get America safely back to work. The Heritage Foundation impaneled the National Coronavirus Recovery Commission to make policy recommendations for restarting the economy. Rob Bluey is Vice President of Communications and Executive Editor of the Daily Signal. He now serves as spokesman for the commission and joins us. Rob, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Rob, Heritage Foundation has impaneled the National Coronavirus Recovery Commission. Please explain for our audience what the commission is and what its goals are.
Heritage decided that it was important to bring together a group of individuals, experts in public health, the business community, economists, people who have government experience, to really try to find what the right balance is and answer the question of how and when we get America reopened again. And I think that's a question that's on a lot of people's minds, obviously. What we found and what we were frustrated with is there seemed to be an either-or type of scenario. You had people from the business community who were eager to open things up immediately. You had doctors and public health officials who said, no, we need to remain at home. So what's the right balance? And that's exactly what the commission is intending to do, and that's what our first set of recommendations hope to achieve.
Let's talk a bit about those recommendations. I understand there were, at least 47 of them in the first part. We can't go one by one, but give us sort of the general theme of what the commission is recommending.
We have five different phases that we're looking at. So the recommendations cover the first two phases, and those phases, I think, are the short-term answers that we need to help the American people figure out. And so the recommendations focus on making sure that we reopen our country safely, but we do so expeditiously. So there are parts of our country that haven't been hit with the coronavirus in ways that others have. There are certain hotspots like New York and New Orleans and Detroit, which obviously have had a bigger influx of cases. But there are other parts of the country which haven't had many cases at all. And so does it make sense to keep those parts of America closed? Or can we proceed with reopening them while still exhibiting some of the guidelines the doctors say? Social distancing, make sure that we're washing our hands. Those who are most vulnerable to the virus, making sure that they're taking extra precautions. And so the recommendations really try to provide a structure for governors, local governments, the federal government, and the private sector for how to do that.
There is growing restlessness around the country. We've seen a lot of protests in recent days in various states that have had some of the more strident lockdowns. Your first phase that's being recommended here, Rob, how does it begin to get the process started? I think a lot of folks are looking for a timetable, which is sort of elusive, but what are the first steps we can take?
There is unrest in the country. We've seen the protests. And we recognize that the American people are frustrated. Let's face it, there are public health ramifications for people staying at home and not working. And I'm talking primarily here about mental health and depression and not being able to support your family. And so we need to factor that into our equation as well. Yes, we may be protecting people from COVID-19, but there may be other consequences to that. So we recognize that, which is why we have focused our recommendations first and foremost on state government. We think that as conservatives, the government that's closest to you knows best. So state and local governments probably are in the better position to make decisions. We've already seen that start to happen this week. There are several states that have announced that they will begin a process of reopening. I think Georgia is among the most aggressive. And that's a situation where, in some cases, I think it has to be determined county by county, or even, as our report says, zip code by zip code, and making sure that even as you do go about that process of reopening, you're doing so in a way that the American people feel safe and trust the institutions that are reopening. We've asked people now for well over a month to stay at home. And so it's going to take some time for them to have that comfort level and safety that they can go back out into the world and enjoy a meal at a restaurant or be safe in their workplace.
You've talked about the fact that your recommendations so far are focusing on the first phase or two. What will the second phase of this look like, Rob? Once we get back the initial step of starting to reopen the economy, we all know that it's going to come about slowly and not the, as the phrase is now, flipping of a light switch. But where do we go to from phase one into phase two and phase three?
Phases one and two are really focused on returning our reopening our country and then also expanding the testing. And so those are covered in the recommendations we've just released. And the next set of recommendations, we're focusing on how do we improve the science and then how do we serve as a leader internationally for other countries? Because let's face it, the United States is not in this alone. Yes, we have the greatest number of cases, but there are international implications. For instance, the fact that we've suspended travel to several countries, continents, frankly. And so in terms of expanding the science, you know, there's been a lot of focus on what can we do to test people's immunity, to give them the confidence that either maybe they've already had COVID-19 but didn't know it yet because they were asymptomatic. There's anywhere between 25 and 40% of the cases are said to be asymptomatic. So there's a great number of people who may not have had any symptoms. And then also, as we look ahead to being an economic leader, we want to use this time to get back to those core free market principles that we believe in. Obviously, the government has stepped in quite aggressively with direct payments to Americans and with the loan program for small businesses. But what are those next steps that we need to take, fiscally responsible steps? And so I think that's what you'll be seeing in the weeks to come.
There are concerns that once we reopen the economy as we head into next fall and winter, when viruses tend to reemerge, that we could have a rebound pandemic. Are there recommendations for safeguards that if we start to see the virus popping up, that we're going to be able to knock it down without it going nationwide, worldwide, as it did this past year?
It's really important to focus on that, and thank you for raising it. That's actually the last phase of the commission's framework, is to figure out how exactly to prepare for future pandemics or even reemergence of this one. What we don't want to find ourselves in a situation is where we reopen everything and then have to suddenly close it again, because that is going to just send shockwaves through the economy. It'll be much more difficult to recover from a second closure than the first one. And so I think the American people have done what their government has asked them to do, but we want to find ourselves in a situation where we're much better prepared in the future. And you're right, there's a situation where maybe in November, December, or early next year, we could have emerging cases of the flu and find ourselves in a situation where our hospitals, again, are in a critical situation. And so I think that it's really important that the American people take the measures that they need to do, those safety precautions, whether it's washing your hands more frequently or wearing a mask out in public, just being careful in terms of how you interact with people.
We have been talking with Rob Bluey. Rob is spokesman for the National Coronavirus Recovery Commission. That's a project of the Heritage Foundation, where he is vice president of communications and executive editor at the Daily Signal. Rob, tell us a little bit about Heritage, and where can folks go to read more about the National Coronavirus Recovery Commission?
Well, thank you. The Heritage Foundation is a public policy institution, so we're made up of scholars who look at pretty much every public policy issue there is. And if your listeners are interested in either contributing ideas or reading more about the ideas that we've already released, they can go to coronaviruscommission.com. Right there on the homepage is a form where they can send us their recommendations. And we've had several hundred submissions already, and they are playing a big part in our recommendations because we want to make sure that we're listening to the American people.
Rob Bluey of the Heritage Foundation. Rob, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson, continuing to operate from his home like so many Americans, joins us again to bring us up to date on what's happening in the nation's capital. Scott, good to talk with you.
Hey, Loman, how's it going?
Things are going reasonably well, Scott. Hopefully they are with you. And we're watching as the federal government continues to try and grapple with this coronavirus response and crisis. One of the projects that you're working on, along with a number of others, and I guess everybody's working together remotely these days, something called the Cut Red Tape Coalition. What is this and what is the goal?
This week, Club for Growth joined with other like-minded organizations that are interested in cutting red tape. And we formed a coalition around this idea that when Congress does a legislative response with the next phase, we would strongly encourage them to include measures to deregulate job creators and entrepreneurs, those that are willing to do the type of risk necessary with business formation. And what we've learned throughout our economic history is that regulation has a major cost and a barrier to entry for many job creators. And so what you've seen in the interim period during coronavirus is hundreds of regulations at the state and local level and dozens at the federal level being relaxed, modified, and waived or suspended in order to accommodate a more efficient response and also to allow for things that, quite frankly, we've been standing in the way of. When you talk about telemedicine and telehealth, when you talk about onerous paperwork requirements, there's a lot of things right now that are in regulation and the rules, and it just makes it difficult for folks. And so if we can decrease that cost and help speed along an economic recovery, we think that that would be a good thing to include with a legislative response rather than just throwing all this money at the problem. Deregulating the economy is something that would not add to our debt and deficit impact. Instead, it would provide for very strong pro-growth measures. So that's what the coalition is really forming around. We've got a lot of really strong groups that have joined us in the coalition, including Heritage Action, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, FreedomWorks, Tea Party Patriots, the Job Creators Network, Americans for Prosperity, and many others. So while we build this coalition and include dozens and dozens of groups in the coming weeks, we'll continue to message on that and pressure Congress and the administration to take a really, really hard look at cutting red tape, freeing up our job creators, and really helping accommodate a speedy recovery.
Have you not gotten some impetus for this, Scott, by the fact that in terms of the nation responding to the coronavirus crisis, we've seen the FDA, we've seen all sorts of government agencies remove bureaucratic hurdles, remove regulations, move things along in order to respond to a crisis. A lot of Americans look at this, Scott, and say, well, if it's good enough for us to do in a crisis, why do we even have these regulations and barriers to begin with?
I think that a lot of regulations get promulgated to drive out competition in a market. And that's why, from a basic conservative economic position, deregulating the economy is a pro-growth measure. It creates more competition, it creates more opportunity, and it just drives out this crony capitalism where only those that are big enough to be able to comply are able to continue. You know, you've always heard of too big to fail. There's also a sort of a term in the economic space that one of my expert friends has coined, and it's too small to comply. When you're a small business and you've got these incredibly difficult regulations to navigate, you can't hire an army of lawyers to figure out what the compliance is going to be. And that compliance cost is a barrier to entry. So as we've seen 4.4 million new jobless claims this week, bringing us to over 26 million new jobless claims since the coronavirus economic shutdown happened. We obviously need to do things to encourage the economy to reopen, and we think that deregulating is the best way that we can get started and provide certainty for those that are willing to take the risk to reopen.
You did mention the fact that Congress has thrown a lot of money at this just this past week, yet another phase of money injected into the economy. What was the latest round?
They're calling this one Phase 3.5. It's additional spending on top of Phase 3, the CARES Act, and that included the really popular program among many businesses, the Paycheck Protection Program. That program initially had $350 billion included in it, and they added another $310 billion on top of that this week. The total package was about $484 billion. And in the end, I think you have to look at the situation and determine whether the debt and deficit impact that we're continuing to add as a burden for the future generations is going to be worth it. When does the additional money for the Paycheck Protection Program stop? Obviously, businesses are going to be distressed for a long time. And that's why we think that it's important to start promoting pro-growth activities rather than just throwing money at a problem.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, as always, a few words about the club.
Yeah, the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. Our members are united in economic freedom and liberty, and we certainly believe in pro-growth policies. If your listeners are interested in checking us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org, and our Twitter handle is @clubforgrowth. And I'd also encourage everybody to check out the Cut Red Tape Coalition.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
Talk in Washington has turned to a possible fourth stimulus package, and this time the package could be stuffed with more spending not related to recovering from the coronavirus pandemic. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gives us details.
Congress has only just barely finished passing the latest pandemic stimulus bill, but lawmakers and the Trump administration are already looking ahead to the next massive spending opportunity. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look at the third round of coronavirus stimulus and, more importantly, looking ahead to what could be included in the fourth round of stimulus payments that lawmakers in Washington, D.C. are already talking about. And while it may be too soon to know exactly what will be included in that next stimulus bill, early indications suggest that it could include a lot of questionable spending that probably has little to do with the COVID-19 outbreak. Lawmakers and administration officials have floated subsidies for government-built internet service, bailouts for state and local governments and the postal service, and maybe even handouts to sports leagues that have been shuttered by the pandemic. Here's what Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said this week when asked about that next stimulus bill.
The phase four would be infrastructure. The president's been talking about infrastructure since the campaign. Roads, bridges, broadband, especially broadband now to rural America is very important. We've talked about incentives for restaurants, sports, entertainment, because these businesses have been impacted. The president has talked multiple times about a payroll tax cut. And we've also, we're talking about, in the case of states, the states we've heard from the governors and the fiscal issues of the states.
As Mnuchin noted in that clip, infrastructure spending figures to be the centerpiece of the so-called phase four stimulus. Phase four because that counts the initial, actually pretty small stimulus package that was passed in mid-March just as the coronavirus outbreak was getting underway. Then the record-breaking $2.2 trillion Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, the CARES Act, that cleared Congress in the final days of March. And then on top of that, you had this week's passage of a $484 billion package that was aimed at refilling the programs that were providing loans to small businesses and workers who are displaced by the virus and by the economic shutdowns. President Donald Trump has been pushing for a multi-billion-dollar infrastructure program since the 2016 campaign and even before then. And the coronavirus shutdown provides the perfect opportunity in some ways to do a infrastructure spending bill. It would be a massive jobs program at a time when millions of Americans are likely to be looking for work and a bipartisan win for the president as he heads into re-election. He's also calling for the phase four stimulus to include a payroll tax cut, which is another thing that Trump has wanted for a long time, although that would likely have a pretty limited impact on the coronavirus recovery, and it would take a while for that to have much of a stimulating effect on the economy as a whole. A limited infrastructure bill is probably the most defensible part of the plan that Mnuchin outlined this week. Even so, it's still arguably not the best idea because a federal infrastructure package would probably cater to lobbyist demands, not the demands of the market, says Chris Edwards. He's a budget analyst with the Cato Institute. He says that it would likely include billions of dollars for things like mass transit, even though future ridership for mass transit is probably going to be pretty low. And again, that's the most defensible part of this stimulus plan. A bailout for state and local governments is likely in the offing, too. Senators Bill Cassidy and Bob Menendez, that's a Republican from Louisiana and a Democrat from New Jersey, have already unveiled a proposal to spend $500 billion helping state and local governments avoid a coronavirus-induced budget crunch. And Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi wants to spend $4 billion to help states get vote-by-mail infrastructure in place before November's elections. But elections are run by the states, and that means states should probably be responsible for figuring out how to conduct and pay for them. While state and local governments are more limited in their ability to borrow in response to this crisis than the federal government is, they're not exactly helpless. And at a time when the federal government is putting trillions of dollars on the national credit card to help businesses and workers survive this crisis, I think it's reasonable to expect state and local governments to shoulder their own burdens at least as much as possible. Rural broadband should be an even lower priority. The Obama administration spent more than $7 billion on rural broadband in the 2009 stimulus, but that money was largely not spent wisely. One study of three parts of the country that received rural broadband grants, looking at parts of Montana, Kansas, and Minnesota, found that the government spent about $350,000 per household connected to the internet. And the median home price in those areas was less than $189,000. So clearly not the most efficient spending of government money there. In the years since the Obama stimulus, the market has done a pretty good job of getting rural Americans online. And with the expansion of high-speed mobile internet, there's even less of a reason for the federal government to blow billions of dollars laying fiber optic cables out to the boondocks. The same can be said for the idea to bail out sports teams and leagues, or for entertainment businesses in general, as Mnuchin floated earlier this week. Look, professional sports are understandably suffering from the coronavirus shutdown. Players, staff, stadium workers are all out of jobs for an unknown period of time. It could be a while before sports get back running again. But public efforts should be focused on those workers who are out of work, not the businesses themselves or the franchises, the teams, the leagues, what have you. Bankruptcy is an ugly process, but it's better than a government bailout that isn't even guaranteed to keep any of these businesses out of bankruptcy in the first place. The bottom line here is that governing requires setting priorities, and that's never more important than during a crisis. Members of Congress obviously have a political incentive to spend and spend and spend, but there simply isn't enough money to go around, and in fact, we passed that point a long time ago. It's obvious that there will be more government spending in response to the coronavirus crisis, and it's true that much of that spending will be essential to keeping workers and businesses from collapsing and keeping the economy in some semblance of good shape until we can emerge from this. But separating out the essential things from the nice-to-haves is more important now than ever. The problem is, I don't trust Congress to do that. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out our coverage of the coronavirus, of the stimulus packages, and everything else we're working on at Reason.com. You catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Theater and the arts were brought to a standstill during William Shakespeare's time. How he conducted himself could offer a blueprint for handling the current pandemic. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has this American Radio Journal commentary.
This week included April the 23rd, a date that is known by some as St. George's Day, and by others as the birthday of William Shakespeare. As a graduate of St. George's School and a 50-year member of the Shakespeare Society of Philadelphia, both references are meaningful to me, so I suppose it's not a surprise that I found myself thinking about both of them this week in the current context of the novel coronavirus that has upended life here and around the globe. William Shakespeare was well acquainted with the plague in the 16th and 17th centuries. It brought about an early form of social distancing that required the temporary closure of all theaters in London. Perhaps because of the unexpected free time associated with the quarantines of the plague, he wrote several of his greatest masterpieces during those times, Romeo and Juliet, Macbeth, and King Lear, among others. Columbia University professor James Shapiro tells us that in 1567, a young couple in Stratford-upon-Avon, England, lost two of their children to the plague and then barricaded themselves inside to protect their 3-month-old son, William Shakespeare. The legendary playwright's life was thus saved from and shaped by the plague. In 1593, a year or so before Shakespeare wrote Romeo and Juliet, a powerful plague struck London and theaters closed for 14 months. In Romeo and Juliet, Shakespeare uses the plague briefly. The play features a scene where Friar John is sent to deliver the message to Romeo about Juliet's fake death, but the friar is suspected of being in an infected house and therefore quarantined, making him unable to deliver the message. A 1603 plague outbreak killed over a fifth of Shakespeare's fellow Londoners and returned again in 1610, Shapiro says. The professor mused that, quote, "It may well be that his move toward writing tragedy at this time is a kind of response to the tragedy that his society was experiencing in these years." In King Lear, the title character mentions the plague when cursing his eldest daughter. The king is changed throughout the course of the play, and by the end, the ruler acknowledges the suffering of his people and that he hasn't done enough to take care of them, he says. Professor Shapiro then steps right into our 21st century pandemic by saying, "It may be too much to hope that our national leaders and international leaders right now may have a similar response, that they feel that they too have taken too little care of the social problems." What strikes Shapiro most about Shakespeare and the plague is that the playwright never fled London. He stayed in the city because he understood his job as an artist was to help people come out of difficult periods when the theaters reopened. Despite the uncertainty in the theater world right now, Shapiro is sure Shakespeare will still be on stage when the crisis ends, just as he stuck around for the people of London during his lifetime. As for St. George, the legend is that he killed a dragon that had been terrorizing the local town and demanding daily sacrifices, initially in the form of sheep, and later, perhaps because the sheep were all gone, young maidens. St. George kills the dragon on the day when the young maiden to be sacrificed was the princess, the daughter of the king. Is COVID-19 the dragon of the 21st century, lurking just outside of town and threatening all of us villagers? Or perhaps today's dragon is not the virus itself, but an insatiable government that threatens our civil liberties even as we blithely offer up daily sacrifices. Whether we look to Shakespeare or St. George, the lesson we can all take from this week is that we must remain and fight, never cowering, and one day, maybe armed with a mythic sword like a vaccine, we may find that soft flesh under the dragon's wing and slay this coronavirus dragon for good, hopefully before we have grown too accustomed to living off the government. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, KNCW-FM in Omak, Washington. Welcome to our new listeners in the Evergreen State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.